Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. We begin today with a study of a remarkable, often controversial woman. Joan Kroc is perhaps one of the most underappreciated philanthropists of our time. A new book called Ray and Joan, The Man Who Made the McDonald's Fortune and the Woman Who Gave It All Away, tells the story of the couple's tumultuous marriage and the billions of dollars Joan donated over the course of nearly four decades. With us now is author Lisa Napoli. She's been a reporter for Marketplace, the New York Times, and MSNBC. Lisa Napoli joins us from Los Angeles, California. Lisa, welcome to In the Moment.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I'm watching the trailer for the new movie, The Founder, this morning, and Michael Keaton is doing his Oscar thing there. And then there's a little scene with a blonde at a piano, and that's where we begin, with the blonde at the piano, because that's her, right?
Yes, that's Joan. That's Joan. And that they don't include the South Dakota chapter of Joan's life in the movie, but I include it in the book, and it was an absolutely fascinating part of her history to research.
Tell me how you came across her in the first place. She was a mystery from the beginning that you wanted to unpuzzle.
Yeah, you know, anybody who listens to public radio hears her name at least once a day. And I worked in public radio, so, you know, I heard it doubly because of that. And here in Southern California, I was covering arts for a while for a public radio station, and I stumbled upon a sculpture that was in disrepair that was going to be dismantled if they couldn't raise the money to fix it. And it turns out that Joan Kroc had anonymously funded that sculpture years before, and it made no sense to me because I didn't know that she had any connection here. And I went in search of a biography of her, trying to line up the gift to public radio and what little else I knew about her, and I couldn't find one, so I wound up writing one myself.
You were the person for the job.
And it's
necessarily an easy thing to piece together, including at the back of the book where you have an appendix trying to piece together all her donations and a catalog of her philanthropy that doesn't even fit in the book. Tell me about that process of just trying to uncover what she gave and to whom.
Well, you know, we hear so much about biographies. There are so many wonderful biographies written each year by people who have access to some notorious or famous person's papers, or having interviewed them, or access somehow. And Joan really didn't want people to reconstruct her life. She went out of her way. She died in 2003, but she went out of her way to make it difficult to do that. So that made the process of researching her life even more difficult, because there was no one spot to go to. And in fact, the South Dakota part of her life I only found as a throwaway line in a book that was written about McDonald's. And the corporation, by the way, did not help me in any way in doing this. So, it was a bizarre constellation of Sherlock Holmes digging and, looking in under various corners and looking for people who were still around from the various phases of her life.
So what do you find in Rapid City?
So it turns out that Joan, you mentioned that she was at the piano, which mm-hmm. is true, when Ray discovered her in St. Paul, which is where she was from, Minnesota. And he had gone in there to sell a franchise to the boss of the restaurant, the owner of the restaurant. And Joan's first husband was hired to manage that first McDonald's in St. Louis Park, Minnesota, and did so well at it that he got the right to open his own McDonald's. Of course, he had to pay for it. And he and Joan moved to Rapid City, where they opened the first McDonald's in South Dakota in 1959 on Main Street. There's still a McDonald's there. And that unleashed about a 10-year swath of time where Joan, with her young daughter and her husband, relocated. They were there, and they were part of the community. She played piano, she taught piano, and she helped her husband build a mini McDonald's empire, which was the case in the early days of McDonald's. When someone got the right to build one, if they did well, they built another and then another. And there's still some families today that own a number of McDonald's in one location, and of course made quite a lot of money. So that was part of Joan's connection to the state.
Now, she's expected to be part of the business enterprise in what way? What's her expectation as the wife of the franchise owner?
Great question. You know, women were not allowed to work in McDonald's at that time, in the front of counter or even behind the scenes, except if they were the wife of an owner. And as the wife of an owner, Joan not only helped oversee the literal construction of the restaurant, the Golden Arches, but she helped order food and crew up, you know, the necessary men to work in the restaurant. And so there's a very funny story about how when she first got to Rapid City, you know, and it's also important to point out that back then McDonald's were not, food was not hauled in on a truck. You got your food locally. You ordered the buns from a local baker. You ordered the meat from a local butcher. And you order the produce that way too. And so Joan had called up a local purveyor of potatoes, of course, an important part of McDonald's, and had asked for 100 pounds, which is what the manual that you bought when you were a franchisee, or that you got when you were a franchisee, specified. And she told this produce purveyor, I need 100 pounds of potatoes. And the guy said, you are crazy. There's no way you'll go through that much. And she said, no, it says I have to order that much. And he reluctantly and sort of officiously dumped this potato stock at her door, and in fact she went through it in the first week. So the blueprint was actually really, really accurate about what to order, how many nickels to have in the cash register, and it's just a funny, quaint remembrance to think about the time that food was locally sourced at McDonald's, right. And to imagine that Joan, who wound up marrying the boss and inheriting billions of dollars, was actually on the ground in the stores, actually doing the hard work of running them.
Ordering the potatoes and the buns, which have to be made in a certain kind of tin or whatever you would call it, and cut in a certain, it's almost militaristic in the level of detail that they have to sort of obey to. So it's a restrictive kind of environment to you know, seal the franchise expectation. It's a restrictive sort of environment for women who can't even work at the front counter. How in the world does she go from being the wife of this owner to actually running off with Ray Kroc?
Well, you know, love works in mysterious ways, right? And Ray had fallen in love with her at first blush when he walked into this restaurant in St. Paul. He was a pianist himself, and so he was taken not just by Joan's blonde beauty, as he described it in his memoir, but by her proficiency at the keyboards. And she was incredibly proficient. I wish I could have heard her play myself. I met a number of people in Rapid City who recalled that about her. Mm-hmm. But what happened was they carried on an affair for a number of years. There was an attempt at marriage earlier on when not long after they got to Rapid City, and Joan came back to Rapid City, stayed with her husband, raised her daughter, and then when her daughter was a bit older, reconnected with Ray because of McDonald's at a McDonald's franchise convention, and off they went to begin their life together in Chicago. But she never forgot Rapid City. In fact, came back quite often, and at one point donated all of her Western arts, which was quite a formidable collection, to the city. So that's an interesting story, too.
You say in the book that she has a lopsided nature. What do you mean by that word, lopsided? She's sort of a dichotomy, isn't she?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. When we think, or at least when I think, of a wealthy philanthropist, I think of a very staid person who's sitting around, maybe there's a board, and they're working with the board to deliberately give out money to places, you know, and cutting the checks, and it's very formal. Mm. But Joan was the opposite of very formal, even though she, when she became very wealthy, had beautiful jewels and spectacular art and homes. She was a smoking, piano playing, she had a ribald sense of humor, very off-color sense of humor, and she was very impetuous. Apparently she would call the people who worked with her in her inner circle at all hours of the day and the night. She was a news junkie, and once things like CNN came about, she became completely wrapped by news headlines and would often want to respond to things that she saw in the news, most notably, at least for our purposes in this conversation, the Grand Forks floods in 97. Mm. She saw night after night this terrible flooding, and she had experienced floods in Rapid City. She wasn't there for the most devastating flood, but her ex-husband, the father of her child, was. So that had been an early gift for her to the Rapid City flood relief. And when the Grand Forks floods happened and she was watching them on TV, by then she lived in San Diego, she wanted to cut a check and she wanted to do it anonymously. So she would just send someone out on her private plane, and it's almost like a TV show, and they would arrive in town, you know, with little fanfare, as much as you could do that with your private plane, and write a check. And that's what's so interesting to me about her. Not that there's anything wrong with people who give money in a more traditional, formal way, but I love that she just reacted the way any of us would, except that she had a lot more to give than most people do.
There's so much to talk about here. We're going to run out of time. The book is called Ray and Joan, The Man Who Made the McDonald's Fortune and the Woman Who Gave It All Away. My guest, Lisa Napoli. Lisa, just leave us with the thought that you wanted to write this book partially to inspire other people to think about money in a different way. Let's just close with that.
Most of us don't have the $3 billion that Joan had at the end of her life that she chose to give away, but we all can be inspired by things that we see in our orbits, immediate and otherwise, to do something. And I love that about Joan, and I carry that message with me every day, that we can help in some way. We just have to not hold ourselves back or be afraid to do that, and she certainly wasn't.
It's a remarkable book. Lisa Napoli, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
After the break, SDPB's Keely Boltina takes you to Huron to look at a creative way of dealing with workforce shortage. Stay in the moment, SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. You've heard the phrase workforce shortage often, as South Dakota sees low unemployment and a mismatch of skills with job openings. Local hospitals and clinics are not immune. One area health organization is paying to train students for positions they can't fill. In turn, students learn on the job during internships and commit to staying in town for a few years. SDPB's Keely Boltina brings you this story from Huron.
What looks like a small refrigerator. It's really an incubator, and Bain pulls a bright red petri dish from the warm climate specifically tailored to growing germs. Silvery gray blobs form a squiggly line.
This would be an example of a sample from a urine sample, and so all of these colonies growing on the plate represents the fact that this patient had a urinary tract infection and will need some antibiotics to get rid of that.
Bain says culturing infections is a critical lab function at Huron Regional Medical Center. Trained professionals must prepare samples and perform tests. Medical Center President and CEO David Dick says staffing these positions is not quick work.
You just have to put in the effort now. You know, the contributions made to that periodically, systematic over time. You can't all of a sudden create a program like this.
Dick refers to a program that uses money from the HRMC Foundation's Fund for the Future. The foundation covers between $5,000 and $32,000 for tech school or college training when students commit to working in an area of need for several years.
It's a way to give to the community as a whole, because by having that person come back, they're also now an employee in a purchaser of services here.
Dick says these students often have ties to Huron and want to stay, but they are not aware of the kinds of work they can perform. He likens the role of the health system to a familiar concept, parenting school-aged kids.
I delegated responsibility to the school, but I became accountable for their education in the sense that if they didn't get one, they'd probably live with mom and dad. If we're short of a worker, you know, have we put enough work into the high schools to let people know what kind of jobs are available, all the different varieties of healthcare jobs.
One dozen of those positions at Huron Regional Medical Center are in the lab. Mitchell Tech student Greta Heinricher has her eye on one of them.
I had thought I wanted to be in nursing for the longest time. So when I got to lab, that's when it kind of clicked.
Heinricher is now interning at the medical lab, sliding samples under the microscope and identifying health concerns.
You're looking at the white blood cells, and you have to count all the different white blood cells. There's neutrophils, there's basophils, there's eosinophils. What you're also looking at is the red blood cells, the morphology, which is the shape. And you're also looking at platelets and the size. So you're not just glancing at it. You have to actually take a little bit of time and look through everything efficiently.
Lab director Owen Bain says a fully trained specialist checks Heinricher's work.
When they're doing their internship here, they're paired with an experienced laboratory professional that so they can see and compare their results, how they do things, and just following standard procedures every time they do a test.
Bain says everyone doing everything the same way ensures that lab tests have integrity. The results are the basis for many medical decisions. He shows me a sample of sputum, mucus someone coughed up, is examined under magnification.
Look in the microscope, and right in the center of the field, there's bacteria, and they're kind of round, and there's like four of them together called a tetrad. But
yeah, they're right there.
And they're blue, which is called gram-positive. And they're, so those are bacteria, and then kind of up, moving towards 1 o'clock is an epithelial cell. It's kind of a big...
It's giant.
Giant with a nucleus in it. And so, like I said, this was a sputum, so this person obviously probably has a pneumonia.
Bain says identifying that allows lab professionals to culture and confirm health problems, and it gives doctors evidence to treat people and save lives. The medical lab in Huron includes 12 people. Bain says one of those positions has been open for a year. He says he thinks people miss out on the opportunity to contribute in a lab because the work is not high profile.
We're kind of behind the scenes, and the only time you see a laboratory person is maybe they're going to draw your blood. We take the samples, you know, back to the laboratory and give the physician a result. So you never see us, or you see very little of us.
Bain says the Fund for the Future is helping people discover the value of lab work while maintaining ties in the community. He says the new hires help meet the demands of 24/7 healthcare. For South Dakota Public Broadcasting, I'm Keely Boltina in Huron.
The HRMC Foundation's Fund for the Future targets areas of need in the health system. When those spots are secured, new scholarships sponsor other positions leaders have difficulty filling. Other high-need degrees include respiratory therapy, licensed practical nurses, and more. We've set up a link to more information at our website. Visit listen.sdpb.org. Sioux Falls recently hosted the NHL-USHL Top Prospects game for junior hockey players hoping to catch the eyes of National Hockey League scouts. 40 teenage hockey players participated in the two-day event, which took place at the Sanford Premier Center in Sioux Falls. SDPB's Steve Zwemke joins us to recap the Top Prospects game and talk about its impact and importance. Steve, I'm wondering how the game ended up in Sioux Falls in the first place.
Yeah, thanks, Lori. It was actually an application process, and because the Sioux Falls Stampede is highly successful and has been for many years, I'm sure it was an easy choice. I think the process actually started about a year ago. So the United States Hockey League is the highest level of junior hockey in the U.S. It's mainly a feeder to college programs around the country. Last June, 4 USHL players were taken in the first round of the NHL draft, which really speaks highly. Some former USHL players that are thriving in the National Hockey League right now. Tell me if you recognize any of these names. TJ Oshie, Thomas Vanek, Max Pacioretty from the Montreal Canadiens, yeah. Johnny Gaudreau, they call him Johnny Hockey.
All right.
Joe Pavelski and David Backes. And really, Lori, I'm just scratching the surface because those are some of the bigger names, but there are many, many more that are playing in the NHL right now. The thing about the Top Prospects game is that it's a showcase, very much unlike the NHL All-Star game, which can seem very dispassionate. And I visited with Jim Olander. He's the Executive Vice President of Business Operations for the Sioux Falls Stampede. He explains the importance of the Top Prospects game and just how important it really is for these players.
In many ways, yeah. I mean, it's a different, you know, and that was probably the hardest thing that we had to explain to not only fans but even media members, and I think some maybe still didn't understand what it was, and that, you know, it's not an all-star game. It's the top 40 prospects in our league from the USHL. They were hand-selected by the National Hockey League. The NHL has what's called the NHL Central Scouting System, and these guys go out and they watch all these USHL games, and they basically rank the players, and it's more of a prediction. It's not an exact science, but prior to this game, they've been rated A, B, or C. An A rating is a player that's projected to go in the very first round. A B rating is rounds 2 through 3. And then a C-rated player is rounds 4 through 6. So these guys were selected for a reason. They're guys that not necessarily all going to get drafted, but they're on the radar from these NHL clubs. And, you know, we had every NHL team had at least one scout here. And in total, we had nearly 130 NHL scouts at the game. So it makes it a little more exciting, I think, for a game, too. And you could sense it even in the game. There's, you know, there was great defense. There was hard hitting. It wasn't kind of a laid-back, all-star, typical game where, you know, nobody's playing defense and trying real hard. The guys were, if anything, probably a little bit more nervous than they normally would be just because of the crowd and obviously all the scouts that were there to watch them.
Tell us about the game and who stood – it sounds like the goalie stole the show, but who stood out in that game?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because we were talking about it on the broadcast with the game, and, you know, it was very unique because we talk about that rating system, and all four goaltenders that were playing – were B-rated skaters, mm-hmm. Again, meaning potential second to third round picks. And it's unique because the goaltenders, it's very difficult for goaltenders to get drafted. You know, obviously on any team, you got two goalies, right? So, you know, forwards, there's plenty of forwards, and you maybe have a little bit better of a chance. But as a goaltender, you know, there's not too many. So they're pretty selective on who they have. But in this game, you know, you had Dayden Rasmussen of Tri-City, one of the top goaltenders in the league, and then Caden Primo from the Lincoln Stars. They combined for Team West for the shutout. And then you had Keith Petruzzelli from the Muskegon Lumberjacks, who came in. I think he had 22 saves. He came in for Team East and really shut down the West for the remainder of the game. So those guys were really two of the guys that stuck out. Nick Swainey was another guy from Waterloo that played well, had a goal. He's projected first, second-round draft pick in the draft. And then Paul Washey had a couple of goals for Tri-City, too. And he was a guy. He was the Team West player of the game, MVP. And that's what I think makes this game fun, too, is, you know, Paul Washey's a good player, and shouldn't say that he hasn't stood out before, but maybe you wouldn't have expected him to be the guy scoring two goals, and his stock probably rose a little bit and turned some eyebrows with the way he played in the game. So that's what this game can really do. That's the excitement of it, that, you know, if you have a good game, you can really, you know, kind of turn the eyes and turn the heads of some of these scouts, and they're going to start watching some of these guys a little bit closer as the year goes on.
Yeah, and it really depends player to player, too, because depending upon the system you're in or maybe where you are in your maturation as a player, some of these players don't necessarily mature until later on in their hockey careers, too. I mean, it's possible, you know, one of these players may be overlooked this June, but after a season or two in D1, their stock might be way up compared to where it is now, too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and that's the difficult thing probably, I think, of the NHL draft is just, you know, you're trying to project a guy, you know, 5, 6, maybe even 7 years down the line, mm-hmm. when they're getting drafted, because it's similar to baseball where, you know, it's not the NBA, it's not the NFL where the next year, you know, for the most part, there's always exceptions, but for the most part, they're not going to be joining the team. They're going to be spending at least a couple of years in college, and if not, still playing another year in the USHL. So, you know, I think it's a difficult thing for NHL teams to try and figure out, and you're right, it's sometimes you get it right, sometimes you don't, and sometimes you're right, the guy might not play as well the first half of the season, might not get noticed, but he might, you know, mature, and even if you don't get drafted this year, it doesn't mean it's over. And that's one of the things they told the guys when they first you know, came to Sioux Falls here on Sunday when they all met. They, you know, had a meeting and said, hey, you know, if you don't get drafted or if it doesn't work out, it's not the end of the world. You know, you still got other opportunities. You got to keep working hard. And I think, you know, Sioux Falls fans would remember Charlie Lindgren's a great example of that, goaltender for the Stampede. He was not drafted, and you know, lo and behold, he has a great, you know, start to his collegiate career, and he basically at the end of last season had the pick of the litter as far as NHL teams going, because he had a lot of teams knocking on his door, and he had the opportunity to you know, to select where he wanted to go, and he picked Montreal, and you know, signed a professional contract, and now he's playing in the American Hockey League. So things can happen quickly, but certainly it's not life or death if you're not able to make it. If you are, you know, it gives you a little extra motivation and you have a little tie-in with the team. But if you don't, you know, there's still a great opportunity for you to make it as a player.
Are NHL scouts allowed to visit with players at the Top Prospects game? I know the NCAA has their rules on things like that, but how about like with the Top Prospects game?
Yeah, that's a good question. Not really. They weren't. There wasn't one-on-one interviews. That typically happens at the NHL Combine, where that's going to be some of your top picks, much like the NFL Combine. You know, it's a very similar thing. They go through testing, do stuff like that, and that's where teams will do more one-on-one interviews, and they're allowed to do that. But in this particular case, they're more or less just watching. To my knowledge, I don't think that they're talking. I don't think there's any necessary rules that they can't talk to a player. But it's more of once they get closer to the draft is typically when they are a little bit more in contact with players. And a lot of these players, as time goes on, if they're going to be draft eligible, will have family advisors who kind of help them through the process and talking to teams and those types of things. So it's a little bit different in that aspect, that they're not quite, you know, like the colleges, but again, they're talking to the teams, they're talking to colleges, they're talking to the coach of the team, you know, hearing about what this player is, from time to time, you know, they might even come to a practice and watch a little bit closer, but for the most part, they're just observing during games. And I think as you get closer to the draft, then you start to see things intensify a little bit more towards the end of the season.
For hockey fans in general, this was a really exciting event, too, because not only were there plenty of NHL scouts, but there were broadcasters, journalists from around North America that follow hockey, and other dignitaries. Tell us, just kind of give me an atmosphere, and maybe tell us who some of the dignitaries that attended this event.
Yeah, you know, it did bring a wide range of people. You know, we had Craig Simpson here from NHL Network Radio and doing actually a live show. He has a morning show on XM Radio, and he was here Tuesday and Wednesday interviewing players, interviewing some of the coaches, some of the USHL executives. So that was fun to see. We had Pat LaFontaine, who was here, NHL Hall of Famer. Actually spoke at our luncheon and spoke with the players briefly as well and took in the game and was actually also here as part of the NHL and kind of dealing on the business side with the USHL and helping out with some of those aspects. And also had Matt Maka here, the chief operating officer of the Minnesota Wild. He was our keynote speaker at our luncheon and had an opportunity to speak with the players and talk about the process of the Wild and what they're looking in players and how you know, they structure their team and put their team together. So, you know, there were all kinds of, you know, and then in addition, obviously, there were all kinds of different, some of the general managers from NHL teams were here. All the head scouts were obviously here. So it did bring a lot of different people to Sioux Falls, and for many of them, you know, their first visit to Sioux Falls, which I think was extra special too.
Looking back 17, 18 years as to where hockey is, not only in Sioux Falls, but in this region compared to where we were 18 years ago, it's really remarkable, isn't it?
It really is. I mean, and this is I'm going on my 14th season, and even since I've been here, I mean, the growth of this sport is unbelievable. There wasn't, you know, before the Stampede, there wasn't much going on, period, and certainly there was youth hockey, but not to the magnitude it was now. And to look at where we're at now, you know, and it starts with the Shields Iceplex and the work that they've done over there for us, you know, for many, many years, you know, to just basically have one sheet of ice here in Sioux Falls, I think was probably the biggest reason we didn't see a big growth in hockey, because there just wasn't any ice time for anybody. And, you know, that means late night practices or early morning practices. And certainly with any, as you grow, you're still going to have some of those, but I think that's shrunk significantly. And now you've got a three sheet ice complex at the Shields Iceplex, you know, that not only for hockey but figure skating. You know, we just teamed up with a sled hockey team here for a first ever in the area, Sioux Falls sled hockey team, which is exciting. And then, you know, we've got the junior stampede here now, too, which is bringing players, you know, at a little bit younger level, but bringing players from all over the United States here to Sioux Falls to play as well. And I think that's exciting. And I think, you know, we're certainly can't sit here and take credit because youth hockey and the people that they have running those programs have really stepped up and done a great job. But I think hopefully what we've provided is, you know, we're going to get to a point where we're going to see a lot more of these youth hockey players get to that next level and play in the USHL and want to play for the Stampede. And that's kind of where we're at right now, where, you know, these guys look up to the Stampede players and they want to play in the USHL. They want to play for the Stampede. And that's something that's real special.
Lori, not only is Jim Olander in the business office for the Sioux Falls Stampede, but he's been their play-by-play announcer on radio for the 14 years that he said he's been with the organization. But really, with that overview, you get an idea of how big this event was for these teenage hockey players, 40 of them that converged on Sioux Falls. And as far as hockey goes in the state of South Dakota, it was probably the biggest event we've had here, with the exception maybe of the championship games that the Stampede and the Rapid City Rush of the ECHL have played in. It was just a huge event.
The Sioux Falls Stampede had players in the top prospects game, Steve, but do any of them come from South Dakota, or are they all from out of state?
Yeah, there's one player that actually grew up in Sioux Falls that was part of the top prospects game, and that's Walker Dewar. Sioux Falls is still his home base, actually, and he plays for the Chicago Steel in the USHL. He's one of a very, very small handful of players from South Dakota who have gotten to this level of hockey. I'm not even sure there's been more than five that have played Tier 1, which is what the USHL is. So, you know, him being one of the few, he got a lot of media attention while he was at the top prospects game, and I had a chance to visit with Walker about that.
Yeah, I'm actually pretty surprised. I mean, I figured there'd be a little bit just from being from Sioux Falls to be in this magnitude of a game, but I didn't expect this much.
What about being named to the USHL top prospects team? Were you surprised about that, or in the back of your mind were you maybe a little confident that you'd be on that roster?
Yeah, I knew I had a shot at making the roster, but it's also I knew I had to work for it, and it's obviously a great honor to be selected for that game to play in such a great game.
Did a lot of your friends and family have a chance to see you participate in the big showcase event in Sioux Falls?
Yeah, I had a lot of family there and some friends there, so I have a lot of family around Sioux Falls, so they were all there.
Yeah. You left home from Sioux Falls early in your teens to further your hockey career. Since you left Sioux Falls, where have you played up to your time now with the Chicago Steel?
I left when I was 14, and my first year away from home, I played in Las Vegas. And then my second year, I played in Chicago. And then my third year, I played in Sioux City, Iowa. And then my fourth year, I played Kearney, Nebraska. And now this year, I'm playing in Chicago again.
You're seeing a lot of the country already at an early age.
Yeah.
Not a lot of players can say they've been on three different USHL rosters over three seasons, but you have. Even though you're recognized as a top prospect, has it been difficult to have new teammates every year and play for new coaches who might have different systems or different coaching philosophies?
Yeah, there's always different challenges coming joining a new team. You got to meet all the new guys and the new faces and the coaching staff and learn the new styles of play, but it's also, I think, an advantage for me. I've just learned from each and every coach and different playing styles from them, and they've all given me great pointers. So, yeah, it's been difficult, but it's also been good at the same time.
What's your assessment of how you played in front of the NHL scouts during the top prospects game?
Yeah, I thought I played pretty well. I mean, as a team, we didn't put up any goals, so I played pretty well. I mean, there was a little bit of jitters there in the first couple of shifts. So, I mean, I thought I played my game to my best of my ability. It obviously wasn't my best game because it just didn't really help the team get on the scoreboard. But I thought I did pretty good.
Yeah. And when I talked with Jim Olander from the Stampede, he discussed that this is definitely not like an NHL All-Star game. This is an all-out competition because you guys are there to showcase your talents to the NHL, isn't
yeah.
it? Yeah. Do you have any idea where NHL Central Scouting has you ranked right now?
They don't have me ranked yet this year. I was ranked last year 162nd, I think, but I haven't been ranked yet this year.
Sure. What about the top prospects game and the events surrounding that as a whole? What will you remember most about your time in Sioux Falls on or off the ice over the last couple of days?
Just being around family and stuff and being able to share this moment with them. Yeah. It was something special. Just getting the media attention I did, like, that was pretty cool. And then just participating in such a great event, meeting new players around the league, like, that was awesome. And then just participating in such a just a great event. And I'll remember for a long time just being in such a great event.
Sure. Now, you were there. You were on the ice for the game. Who were a couple of players that really stood out during the top prospects game, in your opinion?
I'd say Nick Sweeney of Waterloo on Team West. He played pretty well. And then Paul Washey, also on Team West from Tri-City, scored 2 goals. So those 2 guys had a pretty good game.
As we look ahead, you've already committed to Minnesota State Mankato and will be part of their hockey program. They have a coach there, a guy with a ton of experience in Mike Hastings. Do you see him as kind of like a player's coach, as they say in sports?
Yeah, they have a great coaching staff there in Mankato. That's probably one of the biggest reasons I went there. But, yeah, he's a great coach. He's been around, and, he just knows how to interact with the players and get he knows, like, what makes you play better, whether it be he needs to get on you or, like, he needs to sit down with you and show some tips. But, yeah, I feel like he knows how to really get the best out of his players.
Sure. And Mankato is close to Sioux Falls, too. Did that play played a role in your decision, huh?
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. It was to be able to have such a great hockey school close to home, it was a no-brainer. Once I went there and saw the facilities that were top-notch and met the coaching staff and loved them and loved the campus. So, yeah, Mankato was definitely a place for me.
Sure. What are your hopes and dreams as you look ahead 4 years down the road and you're hopefully coming to the end of your senior season with the Mavericks in Mankato? What's in the back of your mind? What are your dreams?
In hockey, my dreams are probably just to play college hockey and then hopefully pro someday. I mean, that's my ultimate goal, is to be able to play hockey as my job. So that's my ultimate goal. But if not, if I can't play pro hockey, hopefully to get a good job with the education degree I earned at Mankato.
And, Lori, that's exactly what playing in the USHL is all about. It's a pipeline to college, and then after that, a pipeline to the world.
It's a big dream, and a lot of sacrifices go into chasing it down.
It's amazing the effort they put in, but it's really fun to see when it comes to its fruition.
Yeah, I can't believe they start leaving Sioux Falls or their hometowns at such a young age to go into the world and follow that.
You know, up in Canada, it's been that way for decades, but as hockey has become more popular in the States, we see a lot of Americans do that too.
Steve, thanks for that.
You're welcome.
And Walker Duer rejoined his USHL team in Chicago for a pair of home games this past weekend. The Sioux Falls native had 2 assists in the Steels 2-1 win over Sioux City on Sunday night. Up next, one woman's story of texting, driving, and second chances. Stay in the moment. SDPB Radio. Welcome back to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. May 13th, 2016, our next guest was driving down a gravel road on her way to the farm near Hartford when a text message caught her attention. Like so many of us do, she decided to look at it. In an instant, she lost control of her vehicle, overcorrected twice, rolled her truck 4 times, and ended up 70 feet from her vehicle in the opposite ditch. Luckily, Cassandra Grogan, who was not wearing a seatbelt, is here with us to tell the story. Cassandra, welcome to In the Moment.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Very glad that you're here to tell part of this story. So first of all, thank you for that. And thank you for being willing to share it. Tell me what you remember about that accident.
I don't remember a whole lot because I sustained so much injury and it happened so fast. So that fact that it happened so fast already makes it hard to remember. And then I had so many injuries that my body was in shock. So it just kind of shut my system down, which I'm thankful for, because who knows how I would have been handling it if I would have been actually aware. So I was driving to Hartford from Brandon, South Dakota, for work, because I was working at First Dakota Horticulture, and I was just driving along. I was probably less than a mile away from work, and I knew I had a lot to accomplish once I got there. So it was actually a boyfriend at the time that I was seeing had texted me, and I was just like, I'll just check it quick and see what he has to say because I don't know when I'm going to talk to him next.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how it kind of happened. Just
so
I had checked texts all the time. I drove that road hundreds of times because I had worked there before, and you know, I was used to it. I was comfortable.
Yeah, it seems harmless at the time. It really truthfully does.
Yeah, it does.
Especially in somewhat of a remote location. Like
yeah,
that.
Exactly. I didn't meet many cars on the road at the time of day that I was on the road.
And then the next moment is, what's the next moment that you remember after the second you looked down at your cell phone?
So I kind of call it snippets because, you know, my body was in shock. So I kind of remember looking up from my phone, feeling my body rising like on the first roll. And then just a split second of being on the side of the road, like I can remember feeling wet, dewy gravel on my face. But after that, it was days that I don't remember because I was in so much shock. I was on so many painkillers. I've heard all the stories of how I was and what I was saying. I was alert the whole time. I was alert when the physician's assistant found me on the side of the road. I talked to the paramedics, but I don't remember probably... I'm thinking about 3 days until after.
Should you be alive? From what you know about what happened and what your situation was, I'm reading a laundry list of injuries and things that you've working on recovering from, including tearing your liver almost in half, the left kidney, tore your spleen, contusions on your lungs, a concussion, separating your left hip. That's an awful lot. Have the doctors said anything about whether or not you should still be here?
My doctors, and I have quite a list of doctors, have all said, it is an absolute miracle that you're alive. We don't know how you lived. I ended up losing about half my blood volume.
Wow.
And, I just, you know, I love the show Grey's Anatomy. So like little things that I've watched, has made me Google things since. And one of the things that I like researched and looked up was, that the average human body only has about 10 to 12 units of blood.
Hmm.
I lost 6 units of blood. You give about a unit of blood when you go to give blood, and after your body loses about 2 units of blood, your body starts going into shock. So just the blood loss itself, if I hadn't had my transfusion started, I could have died easily just from the blood loss.
Right. You're joining us today to tell this story. You're a teacher. You tell the story to your students as well. Why? Why share the story with kids?
I think it's super important, especially with how today's generations are. We're consumed by technology. We have everything right at our fingertips, at our phone. We're on the constant go, go, go. And when you're sitting in your car, you automatically think, I have a split second, I can check whatever is going on my phone. Like I can check Facebook, I can check my email, I can do whatever, really. I don't think people are quite aware how much that it takes away from your driving.
Mm-hmm.
You're essentially impaired, just like if you were drunk driving. And I know that's a very big taboo. So I'm trying to make it more aware that, hey, texting and driving should be just as bad as that. You aren't focused on your driving. And when I have shared it with my kids, a lot of them became more aware. Like you could just see the light bulb turning on their head, like mom and dad text all the time when I'm in the car with them.
Right.
And I even had one kid say, I'm surprised I'm not dead yet because my parents text all the time when I'm in the car.
Hmm. So, and do you hear back from the parents?
I haven't at all, no.
Yeah, right.
But, like, I've wondered if I would, like, you know, because if a kid brings it up, like, I could see a parent instantly, you know, getting defensive and being like, well, why are you telling me this?
Right. But if they explain why, it's a whole different story for those parents. Do you think it's possible that that kind of sharing with your kids and them passing that on could save lives potentially?
I think so. I know I have had several friends who have been moved deeply by it because I almost didn't survive. They almost lost me. And they do make it a point. Like, I have one that says I try to put my cell phone far away from me as possible, so I'm not tempted to check it. I have other friends who get upset at their loved ones when, like, they're sending a Snapchat and you can see that they're driving because it says they're going like 80 miles an hour down the interstate.
Oh, wow.
You know, and rightfully so, like, it should upset them.
Yeah.
Like, because anything could happen, and
What message do you think gets through to people the most? Laws prohibiting texting and driving, stories like this one. What would have convinced you before your accident to not look at your phone while you're driving ever again?
You know, I think I'm more motivated by hearing stories because there's laws against, say, drunk driving, but people still do it. The fact of the matter is like, yes, there should be laws in place for texting and driving, just like drunk driving. But yes, people are going to break them. It's not until you're in the situation or you know of somebody that, you know, it kind of hits home. And even then, it really doesn't hit home. Like, I wish I could, there's like a machine I could, like, just have people feel what I felt. Like, I battled depression, I battled anxiety, I battled, you know, overcoming everything, learning how to walk again. Until people really experience that, like, firsthand or someone close to you, I'm not sure how, you know, it's going to get through to people.
How did you sort of find the will to come back? Because that's a long journey that you're still making on a daily basis. Where does that sort of grit come from for you?
It comes from just, you know, knowing it has to get done, knowing that if I didn't get up and walk, I wasn't going to be getting to my job in Mitchell because I was in between teaching jobs. I had just started my summer job. I was so excited to get to Mitchell to, you know, be an art teacher because that's what I first went to school for, but I was doing special education teaching beforehand. So just knowing I had about 600 students that were waiting to learn art from me, like, it's just having those little motivations. And when I was in the hospital, they had actually evaluated me, and I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And I just had so much pain that I could not stand up. I had a back brace that wasn't on correctly, and it wasn't helping matters either. So eventually they came in and they told me, you are either going to have to go home or you're going to have to go to a nursing home because you cannot get up and walk right now.
Which is not what you want to hear in your 20s.
No, I was only 23. I turned 24 in the hospital. And I mean, just knowing how, like, I grew up seeing my elderly grandparents in nursing homes and seeing how they were treated and knowing that, hey, if you go there, you're not going to bounce back. Like,
not where you want to be.
And I've bounced back way faster than any of the doctors have ever seen.
My guest today is Cassandra Grogan. She's a teacher from Mitchell, South Dakota, who was checking her cell phone very briefly for a text, lost control of her car, not wearing a seatbelt. Cassandra, let's wrap up with just, what do you want to say to folks who are tuning in and listening to a rather compelling story?
I would just say that no message is worth your life or somebody else's life, especially if you have your children in the car. Your kids are watching you. They will do what you do when they start driving. And I want people to know, yes, I'm alive today, and it's by the grace of God. I shouldn't be here. I was very lucky, and most people don't end up surviving what I survived.
Cassandra, thank you.
So just put the phone away.
Put the phone away. Cassandra, thank you so much for your time. We're glad you're here.
Thank you so much.
Stick around, stay in the moment. We'll see you next hour.